Good evening, everyone. I am Joseph Cotto, and let me tell you about an epic story of victory, defeat, friendship, betrayal, heroism, cowardice, deep respect, blind hatred, and above all else, the struggle for survival. It is my new book, Runaway Masters, a true story of slavery, freedom, triumph, and tragedy beyond 1619 and 1776. Check it out on Amazon by following the link below. Hope that you enjoy the book. Please consider checking it out. Paul likes the title very much.
Yes.
I sent Paul a copy already in the mail. I don't think he's received it yet.
No, I'm looking forward to receiving it. The title is so dramatic and realistic.
Yes, it is.
It's much better than what we're seeing on HBO these days, you know. Yeah.
Oh, I have no doubt HBO's fallen quite far.
Oh, it's terrible.
It wasn't exactly much for me to beat. But anyway, so that is it, folks. Consider checking out the book. Thank you very much in advance. So now, Paul, it's been, I think we didn't even do a show last week, probably because of the 4th of July holiday. But I presume all has been well in your neck of the woods, as I call it, at Schloss Gottfried.
No, it is. Everything is fine at the Schloss Gottfried. Where I reside.
Excellent. It's interesting. I always have imagined Paul as part of like the landed Austro-Hungarian elite. So he's a few centuries too late for it, but at least he's getting there all the same.
Right.
Now it is interesting how crazy things have become, and they keep getting crazier. It's really almost like the country is just trying to outdo itself, not for necessarily leftist activity, even though that is happening, but for just plain weirdness. I'm looking at so many different current events. There was this one thing where this guy was defecating in a mop bucket that this fellow was trying to use in New York City at a subway station. And the level of insanity going on is just really bizarre. The country, I think, is just sort of becoming less and less of a serious place, while at the same time, it's also becoming more dangerous.
No, I think you're absolutely right. What is the heartening information here is that over 40% of the people think the election in November was stolen. Mm-hmm. And, the percentage of people sort of identify with the right seems to be constant in the United mm-hmm. States. Now, there may be an equal number of people on the other side, but there's so many, to use the term of our esteemed Attorney General, Merrick Garland, so many right-wing extremists. Oh, that is people who might have voted for Trump. That's the definition of right-wing extremists. That, you know, it's pretty hard for them, you know, to rein them all in. They're just, you're dealing with large parts of the country by now.
It's interesting that the term right-wing extremist, even though obviously Garland had a specific definition, in terms of what perhaps he really believes but can't act on it, in terms of certainly what the media believes, anyone basically who's to the right of Barack Obama circa his 2008 campaign is now a right-wing extremist. And even many people who get called right-wing extremists have views which are to the left of Barack Obama circa 2008. It's really interesting just how far left this country has gone in such a very short period of time.
You know, it is. Things have accelerated. The radicalization has accelerated enormously in the last few years. Somebody asked me, you know, did I think it was the election of Obama which did it? And I think that was an important signal. Although Trump managed to pull out the election in 2016 because of the quirks of the Electoral College, it was pretty obvious that the left had taken over all command positions. The intersectional anti-white left, LGBT left, these are not traditional Marxists. They're cultural social radicals. And they managed to take over everything, and also became linked to corporate capitalists, who became sort of their main supplier of money. And then, of course, the electronic media, you know, provided wall-to-wall not wall-to-wall, the global propaganda for them. I have a piece on Intellectual Takeout today about how primitive the Nazis seem in the way they generated propaganda in comparison to the left today. The electronic, they can control anything. They can twist any story, make up, and it's not just in the United States. What we do here, you're going to get in Germany and France and Canada, everywhere else in the Western world. You know, it sort of stops maybe with the Czech Republic or Hungary, but throughout, you know, what people like to call self-importantly liberal democracies. I mean, their control is almost total in some places. And I think this really starts with Barack Obama's presidency. The acceleration starts then, you know, and Trump is a kind of interlude, you know, and one of the reasons they destroy him the way they do is to make sure nobody ever, you know, comes along again, you know, and challenges their position of leadership.
Yeah, I was chatting with Keith Preston, I think the week before last, and he mentioned that what's going on now among the Democrats really is a push to solidify their power. That's clearly what it is. And so they really see this as an opportunity to ensure that they have power for many years to come. Unfortunately for them, they did not have quite enough people in the U.S. Senate to get that done, or else it would have been done. But they're trying to, I think, administratively get as much of this agenda through as they can, an agenda which obviously is intended to give them power for the long game. And I will just say quickly that if you have a reasonable, responsible question or comment for Paul or myself, please do leave it via Streamlabs. We won't be on as long as we sometimes are tonight, so please get your stuff in as soon as you can. Thank you very much in advance. Please do get it onto Streamlabs. So, Paul, anything to say about what I just brought up?
No. You're looking for a response to what point that you brought up. I'm not quite sure.
Anything at all. Anything to comment on?
I think is feasible, but it's something that I wouldn't expect from the opposition, is for a Republican, is for someone like Trump, somebody on the popular, identified with the populist right, whatever, you know, he thinks personally, and he was hardly a consistent defender of the populist right. But somebody, let's say somebody like Ron DeSantis, if he becomes president, what is important to do is to make sure you remove your enemies as much as you can from every position in government and in the military and in the FBI. And you do this with, you know, the broad brush used by the Democratic Party in making sure that everyone serves them. If you do this, and it's not just a matter of judges, it's like who serves in the FBI, who is in the Joint Chief of Staff, which is now seems to be entirely populated by these crazy leftists or people who don't want to open their mouths and disagree with the left. The Attorney General, you pick somebody whom you can count on, somebody who's a loyalist, somebody who is the right wing counterpart of Merrick Garland, but maybe looks, you know, a little less geeky. But, you know, you have to be very careful about the people you put in. Trump did not do any of this that I can see. You know, he gave some jobs to his friends who just appointed regular Republican types and so forth. you need somebody who's much savvier, you know, about the political situation than he was or is. Okay, in order to carry this out, and you know, if these people riot, then you call on the army to put it down. One of the reasons the left has become so impudent and so violent is because the right really doesn't do anything. I mean, it had to make up the story about January 6th and Trump voters and this, but there really isn't very much happening on the right. So, you know, you have to sort of create some kind of fascist monster over on the right. But, you know, as I said, the very least you can do is start boycotting a corporate capitalist who support the left, who support Black Lives Matter. You say, we're not going to use any of these products. And you say, we're going to throw this out. We're going to smash Coke bottles, do whatever is necessary. And we're making this statement. And we're going to go on, and we're going to boycott. All of these, and of course, these people are very, very responsive to threats. I suspect this is one of the reasons they're doing it of the left ones, because the left has power, you know, and the left threatens them. Of course, some of these people also believe in this, the nonsense that they're spouting. But I think a lot of it just comes out of fear. And the right doesn't, the right does not generate fear. The right is a joke in the United States.
It's more serious than it is in Canada, to be sure, or Ireland.
Yeah, well, you just picked the worst cases. You know? Canada, Ireland, and Germany. How about those three?
Yeah, although it's not terribly difficult to be better than the right in these countries, because the right barely exists in these places. So that's always worth mentioning. Anyway, folks, like I said, if you have a reasonable, responsible question for Paul or myself, please leave it via Streamlabs, but please don't save it all for the end. This episode won't be as long as some others have been. Thank you very much in advance. Now, let's check out this article from Paul in American Greatness, which he just referred to. It's War of All Against All. That is the article, right, Paul? I have the right one. Mm-hmm. Good. Everything the present Democratic administration is allowing to happen, and which creates chaos and aggravates violence, is aimed at increasing its control. This was published on July 1st. Having listened to speeches about escalating violence in American cities from Joe Biden and Attorney General Merrick Garland, I think a new approach may be necessary to understand their message. The conservative press has been telling us about how Biden and Garland should focus on the suffering of vulnerable blacks who are being shot and physically assaulted in inner cities. The call by Democrats to remove guns and punish gun sellers, it has been explained, is ill-adapted to the problem. The preferred weapons in shootings and holdups are handguns, not the assault weapons that anti-gun activists and politicians have been railing against. Implausibly, Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot has gone after rural Hoosiers. Those are people from Indiana, for those who don't know, whom she has charged with bringing weapons, presumably assault weapons, into her city. Since the gun owners under attack are overwhelmingly white Republicans, Lightfoot is shifting blame for gun crimes onto the other party. Anyone with half a brain should see this. Other conservatives stress the ideological blindness of the Democrats for soaring crime rates, namely their eagerness to defund the police or deny them the means for dealing with violent criminals, the abolition of bail for felons, and the ascription of black-on-black violence to white racism. Paul, very interesting stuff thus far. Anything to say about it before I move along?
Yeah, but all you've done is, you know, read the parts of my commentary in which I present the conventional Republican arguments. But you have to go on in order to reach my counterargument.
Okay, let me skip down a bit because you're talking about Victor Davis Hanson now, and obviously we don't need to hear that. Let's see here. Okay, the steps taken to increase urban crime and then to ban weapons that have little or nothing to do with the crimes in question belong to the same design. The Democrats have been actively promoting civil unrest since last summer when they defended Black Lives Matter, raised millions to bail out the apprehended vandals, and in the cases of Kamala Harris and Maxine Waters, incited further criminal activities. It's not as if the Democrats are clueless about what's going on or are blinded by ideological passions. They have used violence to propel themselves into power by blaming Donald Trump for what they themselves abetted. With media assistance, they attached the label right-wing extremism to Trump supporters after the Capitol break-in on January 6th. From recent revelations, the Democratic-friendly FBI participants were involved in that disturbance, in the response to which has been to fill D.C. jails with suspected conservative, but certainly not FBI, intruders or BLM rioters from last summer. I'm skeptical about New York Post columnist Michael Goodwin's prediction that if pro-police Black Democrat Eric Adams fails to deal with crime in the Big Apple as mayor, quote, it could usher in the end of the Dems' dominance in urban America, end quote. The Democrats' apparent evasion of responsibility in dealing with soaring urban crime is not at all what it seems. Democrats don't mind seeing crime erupt in cities because that may increase their power. So what if they hobble law enforcement while dragging out an irrelevant gun issue? Such policies need not turn off Black voters while heightening the party's popularity among anti-gun activists. The demonstrable surge in violent crime, in which Blacks have been both the perpetrators and the victims, can be blamed on the usual whipping boy, systemic white racism. Criminals supposedly have been driven to violent acts because of systemic white supremacy. And so the solution to this violence must begin with racial reparations, more active support for BLM, and a better financed war against white privilege. Admittedly, the black urban masses may turn their backs on such narratives and follow wiser counsels, but it's entirely possible they won't. Inner city blacks may continue to support politicians who blame whitey, that is, poor whites, as opposed to the rich, those rich leftist elites who happily incite crime with their anti-white propaganda. That is the end of the article. Now, Paul, anything to say about it?
Yeah, what I'm arguing there is that the Democrats may not have put themselves into a box by not dealing decisively with crime and increasing the police force, giving the police more power, the things that conservatives want them to do. The Democrats may be pursuing a winning strategy by just letting the crime surge. I was looking at some statistics. Now, these are ABC statistics, but I haven't seen anything to challenge them. It seems that 48% of the American people are unhappy with Biden's handling of the crime situation. 38%, you know, heartily approve. They think he's fine. But then when you look at the 48% that don't like what's going on, you say, you know, wherein do we find the, wherein lies the problem? I mean, what should Biden doing that he's, do that he's not doing? The answer is he should be hiring more social workers. He should be taking guns away from people. I mean, some of those who express discontent want a much more radical leftist solution. And, you know, this comes out in ABC polls, some of the other polls I've been looking at. I think I sent Joseph some of these statements about our statistics about what people want Biden to do. He doesn't want, you know, it's not that the even the 48% are all agreed that they want to hire more policemen, let them get tough with the crimes situation, which would have been the response back in the late 60s or early 70s, or even into the 1990s. That, remember, we had the crime bill. That would have been the response. But the people by now, and by people I mean, you know, largely black minorities, woke university students, the woke elites in general, do not, even if they think that crime is not being properly addressed, do not want conservative solutions. They do not want the solutions the Republican Party has come, which I think are the proper solutions. But they don't want that. They want more leftist solutions. So I don't even think the 48%, you know, represents any kind of a uniform conservative backlash.
I think that basically that the inner city vote, particularly the black vote, is lost to the Democratic Party. There's nothing which the GOP can really do to get this vote on its side. I'm just not seeing it. I know you're on the same page, but it's interesting how a lot of Republicans seem to think that, or they claim to think that, you know, the big shift in terms of voting patterns within inner city neighborhoods is just around the corner, and yet that corner is never turned. It's a rather interesting situation, to say the absolute least.
Yeah, no, I think that you're right. I mean, the corner is never reached. And, you know, I've begun to question whether these people I hear on Fox News, for instance, really believe the junk that they're giving us. I think what they're doing is virtue signaling. You know, look what a nice fellow I am. And they say I'm a racist, but, you know, I'm not a racist. I want all these, you know, and all the blocks are coming over to us anyhow. You have to wait till next week for the, or in 2 weeks they'll do it. Or, I mean, this is such utter nonsense. I mean, this is not going to happen. And it's pretty clear it won't. I mean, the Republican Party may be able to peel off more of the Hispanic vote. But as our associate editor, Pedro Gonzalez, points out, they're not going to do it by supporting Black Lives Matter or LGBT, because most of these Hispanics who are going to vote for you are conservative. They're socially conservative. Mm-hmm. They also don't much care about corporate tax rates, you know, for wealthy Republicans or something, or the corporations. They're very happy to get more social programs, and they don't really care about, you know, the economic class at the top. But you know, they are disillusioned with the Democrats. The issue, which I think is very definitely going to galvanize many of the Hispanic votes, is immigration. They don't like the immigration. They don't like the Hispanics coming in across the border illegally, bringing drug cartels. And there has to be already a reaction that has begun in these areas along the Rio Grande River with large Hispanic populations. So we're going to see more of this. The black inner city is hopeless. You know, I mean, it's like trying to get the Jewish Anti-Defamation League to support Trump or something. It's not going to happen.
And I will just say once again that if you have a reasonable and responsible question or comment for Paul or myself, please do leave it via Streamlabs and leave it as soon as you can. We won't be on as long as some other episodes have gone. Thank you very much in advance. I will throw the link back into the live chat, so leave your stuff as soon as possible. With regard to Streamlabs, from K-Max McDonald, for Paul, does the fact that mainstream GOP types say gay marriage is a conservative value, an example of them just ceding that issue or losing on it? Or was it planned all along as a gatekeep? Does the GOP just stall the clock before the left wins an issue?
No, I there's no reason I would think that Republicans are particularly high on gay marriage or LGBT. They're sort of like the conservative establishment. They just keep on collapsing. They don't want to take on social issues. I don't think, let's say, the people on Fox aren't jumping around saying we want more transgendered, and you know, it would light it. Of course, they pretend to be delighted about gay marriage because that's here. But you know, if the left had not initiated it, they wouldn't be pushing for it. So I mean, basically, what they are is a useless opposition. But I don't think they generate and the leftist ideas that later become dominant.
And also from K-Max McDonald, for both Paul and myself, Ramsey Paul did a video on gatekeeping in which he said these types spend all their time attacking those 1 inch to their right and never the left. You ever notice how David French or Jonah Goldberg spend 99% of their time policing the right? I have noticed that, K-Max, to say the least, and there is specifically among a lot of people on the right or the non-left who want respectability from the obviously culturally lefty-dominated media, they and perhaps think tanks as well, if they're in D.C., they do spend a lot of time going after people who are even slightly to the right of it. Obviously, there are some people on the right, particularly the far right, who are very much unsavory characters, but they have such little influence in society that spending all too much time talking about them is really it's just beating a dead horse, essentially. So I think that what French and Goldberg do, they know who their paymasters are, essentially, whether it be at French's publication, which is the Bulwark, or at Goldberg's, which is the Dispatch, and they know that the people who read them are these people who voted Republican for, you know, Bush and Romney, but they never were very warm toward Trump. So they, Goldberg and French, they give these people what they want to hear. And that is obviously bashing, you know, people on the right and, you know, only going after the left on some select issues where there's particularly egregious issues going on in the Democratic Party. So that's my take there. Paul, anything to say about what K-Max brought up?
Yeah, I mean, the practice of denouncing everybody who is even a millimeter to your right, which we see in French and Goldberg and Steve Hayes and some of these other people, is by now a well-established practice in the conservative establishment. Right. I mean, they've done this to the paleo conservatives, to people like me. They've done this to all kinds of people who are positioned, you know, even slightly to the right of where they want you to be. So the fact that Goldberg and others have begun to censor people on their right while calling themselves conservatives is an example simply of taking over the practice of the dominant group, which is always doing this. The question is, you know, can a point, can they, could they reach a point at which their attacks on everybody to the right of themselves make them undesirable even as part of the conservative establishment? And my answer is never. This can't happen. Unless you were to say, like, you know, Max Boot, you know, I hate the Republicans, I hope they lose, and I'm supporting, I don't know, the squad today, and I think Rachel Maddow is great. You have to do a lot. You know, if you move an inch to the right, you're gone. But if you move to the left, they'll let you stay in as long as you call yourself conservative, and they'll continue to invite you onto Fox News, and you become an all-star. I see Jonah Goldberg there a few times a month, maybe more often than that. Steve Hayes, when he's, you know, and what do they say? That the Republicans are full of right-wing extremists. And, you know, but the one thing they like about the Republicans is war, starting wars and, you know, fighting the anti-Democrats, imposing human rights on every, inflicting our human rights on every, they love that stuff. And the, you know, Fox News and the conservative establishment generally is neoconservative in foreign policy. So is Pompeo, even more than Bolton, although some reason people didn't notice this. So that they're on foreign policy, these bulwark dispatch people are perfectly fine, and they have not openly disavowed the Republican Party. You know, just they don't find too many Republicans they're going to support. They also don't typically say, "I'm going to vote for Biden or someone." So Goldberg did not openly come out for Biden. He may have voted for him. The same for Steve Hayes and maybe David French did. they also spend a lot of time attacking right-wing extremism, racism, homophobia. They don't care. It's racism is the big thing for them. And Trump was a racist, seems anti-immigration and so forth. But you can get away with these. These are mild deviations for the conservative establishment. If, you know, David French were to wake up tomorrow and say, you know, I've been thinking it over, and there are socially significant IQ differences between white and blacks, he'd be gone in a second, right? He would disappear from the planet, you know, except as a whipping boy in the New York Times or something like that. And there's certain things you know you're going to say, but if you decide that, gee, we just haven't done enough for lesbians lately, or, you know, there's, we should give, more time to celebrating gay marriage or something like that, you know, or have, let more people come into the country and, you know, more naturalized citizens, even if they cross the border illegally. You can get away with all that stuff. So I don't think the dispatch bulwark pseudo-conservatives are doing anything that, you know, likely, at least now, they're not doing, and it will likely get them expelled from the conservative movement.
Yeah, these publications exist, I think, really to serve as a mouthpiece for the views of those who fund them. They're glorified propaganda rags, and they're not even glorified that much. They're just really propaganda rags.
You sort of wonder if they're getting paid by Democrats, you know, to do this. Because the link was the Lincoln Project or something, yeah. I mean, they were being paid by the Democrats. So you wonder if the Dispatch or, although they're probably not, there's probably a lot of neoconservative money out there that's going to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Lincoln Project obviously is an interesting case.
A front for the Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. Founded by, you know, anti-Trump Republicans, but then it had its own internal issues and a lot of folks left. And now it's sort of like a relic of its former self that's, I think, it's lost its luster. It's basically just like any other Democratic PAC. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, no, I think that's the case.
Yeah. Sorry, were you going to say something, Paul?
No, I was not. I think the Lincoln Project is different from Dispatch, mm-hmm. you know, because it's much more explicitly pro-democratic and getting money from the Democratic Party.
And from Statics, what do you think of some in the conservative movement, including Breitbart, joining the left to attack Representative Paul Gosar for fundraising with Nick Fuentes. Besides some of them being, I'll just put it this way, a controlled opposition, conservatives are just pathetic losers. I think that, you know, first and foremost, I actually criticize Gosar for this. To go around with Fuentes in this day and age is something of career suicide. I mean, if you can't even have a show on DLive, it means you're pretty toxic. For whatever reason, I'm not going to get into, you know, the nitty-gritty of Nick Fuentes. But I think that Gosar is making a terrible career move. And I would not be doing that myself, to say the absolute least. Now, as far as people joining up with the left to castigate Gosar for what he's doing, I think that it is quite natural in a way, because even people who are on the non-establishment right find Fuentes, quite correctly, understandably, to be a liability in that he has such a small base of people who really like him and such a large base of people who find it to be repugnant that you can't even have a serious right of center, right wing even movement and have Nick Fuentes be its public image or have him in any way control that public image. So it's a good tactic, actually, to not affiliate oneself with Fuentes, even if you are someone like Breitbart, so on and so forth. I don't think that really conservatives or people who call themselves rightists, whatever, not coming to Fuentes' defense or to Gosar's defense or for palling around with Fuentes, I don't think that makes them pathetic losers. As a matter of fact, it's a very good political self-preservation strategy. Paul, anything to say about what Static's brought up?
Yeah, sometimes you sort of get strange bedfellows in politics. I mean, when it came to, you know, taking action against the electronic media, trying to break up their corporations and make them, make them into small tidbits. You find Kevin McCarthy, who is sort of an establishment Republican. There's nothing that would distinguish him from, you know, from we call kind of conservatism incorporated. But he's just like a, you know, almost a Chamber of Commerce Republican type. Trying sometimes to sound like a populist, you know, he lands up supporting the leftist establishment and the large electronic media structure, configuration. He doesn't want to break anything up. And of course, he does get money from some of these people, you know, for his campaigns. But then the right, you know, votes with the left to break them up. Now, this is not unusual. And I think sometimes when you get bipartisanship, it is the center left and the center right that seem to be largely, you know, indistinguishable. Then the real right will vote with the left on some issues because it is not as beholden to corporate capitalism. That's something we notice, you know, with Chronicles magazine, that we can say things that establishment conservatives cannot, because they get all their money from large corporations. We don't. You know, we have small donors. We're doing fine, but we have small donors. We're like Bernie Sanders. We have small donors. So we really are not beholden, you know, and if we want to, Pedro Gonzalez or someone wants to beat up on corporations, I don't care. They're not my sponsors. They don't like us. I mean, they're with our enemies over at the Wall Street Journal. I mean, you know, so sometimes you find people, you know, on the real right, who will just, someone like Josh Hawley, for instance, doesn't care. He'll just go after, you know, the electronic media, chop them up. You know, he sounds like Teddy Roosevelt in 1910. You know, as a busting the trust or breaking up the trust or something. So the populist right will do this, whereas the big business Wall Street Journal Republicans won't.
So it's an interesting, it really is an interesting situation, which you just described, Paul. And obviously it's an interesting situation with Gosar and Fuentes. I can see, though, why people who are on the right, even if they're the non-establishment right, don't want to have Fuentes be their public image. Any thoughts on that before we move along?
No, repeat your question. I'm not quite sure.
No, I'm saying that I can see why people, even those who are on the non-establishment right, do not want to have Nick Fuentes as their public image, given, you know, all the stuff that he's been through.
We do not want. We would not want to have Nick Fuentes.
No. I'm not talking about Chronicles. I'm saying that I can see why people who are on the non-establishment right, generally speaking, do not want to have Nick Fuentes as their public image, given the public image which he's cultivated for himself.
Well, I mean, one of the problems you have with this, saying we're not going to allow so-and-so in, is that although I recognize there are limits as to how, limits of tolerance, in dealing with people who are in the non-establishment right. I mean, there's some people who are quite crazy out there. I don't think Fuentes is, but I'd much rather listen to Fuentes than Ben Shapiro. I think he sounds more intelligent, and he certainly says much more interesting things. But I think, there are limits as to how tolerant you can be. And, there are people who talk about some international Jewish conspiracy, headquartered, I don't know, in some hotel in New York or something. I mean, there are people who say really stupid things. And, as I've said in columns, I really don't want these people, to run the non-establishment right. But we simply, cannot engage in the ridiculous censorship that the conservative movement has done. It has destroyed, stifled any real opposition by doing this. I'm one of its victims, and they've been doing this for 40 years now. So we don't want that. And, I think we have to be someone like Ramsey Paul is fine. I mean, I have no idea why he has been a victim of censorship marginalization. So have I. I have no idea why. He's a very nice person, highly intelligent. I agree with most of what he says. So there are lots of people out there. I would be delighted, to have part of the conversation. I know John Derbyshire. I don't always agree with him, but I think, he's highly intelligent, provocative. He should be part of that political. Okay. There's all kinds of people out there. I don't want to begin by censoring, which is what the conservative movement does. So there's some people who, and I like reading Ron Unz, but there's some people writing on his website that I would not want part of my movement. You do have to set up, lines there. You have to, in the end, everybody lands up becoming some kind of gatekeeper, right? I mean, it's almost inevitable. But what we've done now is we've stifled, removed, any kind of interesting, perceptive view on the right. And you always get the impression that what these people in the movement really want to do is cut some deal with the left, with their friends on the left. You watch the Fox News All-Star. Every day they have some black leftist there, some other, some gay, whatever. And all these conservatives are running to be on the same thing, these conversations with bleach blondes and so forth. And they're all like running to come together. This is what the conservative movement seems to be. And one of the things I have to say that I like about some of the Trump supporters, though I don't necessarily agree or like everything that Trump did, but one of the things I like about them is that, is that they are, they're intransigent. This is where we stand. The election was a fraud, and it probably was, there was lots of irregularities. And they'll take this position openly. Like you read American Greatness website or Chronicles, no one is hiding anything, and we are not operating on the principle that if we do this or that, the left is going to like us better. Or they might even let us write for the New York Times or the Washington Post, for really nice people, and or Atlantic Month or the Atlantic. We have no such hope. And you need a right, that behaves more like the left. You sort of know the war that you're in and you're willing to fight it. And you know that your enemy is implacable, and you're not going to run to cut deals with them because you paid off some, black leftist to appear on your program. And the person smiles and would disagree and takes your money. I mean, that kind of deal you don't need.
And from David B., DeSantis and Biden recently held a joint press conference in which DeSantis heaped fawning praise on Biden's offer to pay for the Miami building collapse. Have we lost DeSantis? No, I think DeSantis was just playing politics, and he recognized that in South Florida, there is a growing population of Republicans and also a growing population of moderates, many of whom are not originally from the U.S., that are willing to support the Republicans. And I think DeSantis is playing to that. What happened, the building collapse was in Surfside, which is in coastal Dade County. Dade County is where Miami is, for those who don't know. And DeSantis and Trump, DeSantis did pretty well there, but Trump did magnificently there in 2020. Mm-hmm. And DeSantis, he hopes to actually win Dade County in 2022, which, you know, it's very likely he'll win re-election. Very likely he'll win re-election. Even though the election's not been held yet, it's getting pretty close to as certain as you can be without the election being held that he's going to win that election. But he really does, I think, want to rack up big numbers for himself in the state GOP in Dade County. And he realizes that the bipartisan approach, especially with someone as inconsequential as Biden, it's not like Obama. When Christ embraced him, Obama was a rock star with, you know, a Trumpian level of support from his voters. Biden's nothing like that. So I think DeSantis just figures that this is an opportunity for him to look bipartisan with a fella who has no real following. And that is sort of like a throwaway opportunity that DeSantis can use to his own benefit. And I think he's done that because he's received immense praise from the media in Dade County, from a lot of politicians in Dade County. And I think this is a strategy for him. I don't think DeSantis has been lost at all. And I'm not one of his biggest fans. I don't dislike him. He absolutely deserves a second term. I voted for him in 2018. So I don't dislike him, but he has like a fan club that's pretty crazy online. I'm definitely not part of that. But even I have to say that, he's not doing anything bad. He's not been lost to the GOP. I think he's just making a shrewd move that's done very well for him thus far. Paul, anything to say about what David brought up?
Yeah, I do like DeSantis. I have to admit this. I think he's a very canny politician. Mm-hmm. And I think he sort of tapped into Trump's populist base. I have a question. Who is this Mayor Kava Levine or something?
Danielle Kava. Yes, she is the mayor of Dade County. And Dade County has a mayor, as does the city of Surfside, where the collapse took place. Mm-hmm. It can be very confusing for obvious reasons, all these mayors. Throughout Florida, there are a few counties that have mayors, but otherwise the counties have commission or council chairs. Mm-hmm. And in some counties just chose to call this position the mayor. Florida uses the old English county government system where you have the council chair who runs it, and then the administrator or chief executive that's appointed to deal with day-to-day functions mm-hmm. of government. But in Dade County, they adopted a county mayor who is the chief executive of the county government. And so she's out there doing X, Y, and Z because of that. But Surfside, where the issue happened, also has a mayor. So you have these different mayors, and it's very confusing.
Yeah, she seems to, I assume she's some kind of liberal Democrat, isn't she?
She is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that does that reflect the consensus or the majority view in Dade County?
It does in a way, but it's getting much more conservative all the while. She actually mm-hmm. succeeded a Republican who just got elected to a congressional seat that he picked up from a Democrat in November. So Dade County is in the midst of transition. You see the sort of center-left status quo with Kava, but then you see with the seats that the Republicans picked up in November, when she was elected, by the way, you see this sort of burgeoning GOP voter base. So Dade County is certainly in transition, and you see both sides represented today in its public servants, or so-called public servants.
Yeah, I assume that the black congressman, what's his name, Donald,
he's from Naples.
He's from Naples, right. I assume most of his base is white. Is that correct?
Well, it's like close
like
to
about 99%.
Yeah, yeah. Something like that, yes.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, he comes from the other end. He's from South Florida, but he's on the Gulf Coast.
Right.
And all the other stuff is on the East Coast. So it's rather interesting how the GOP is becoming dominant on both, you know, coasts of mm-hmm. southern Florida. But otherwise, the GOP is dominant on both coasts, period. I mean, once you go north of South Florida, with the exception now of Duval County, but even in the areas of Duval County, which is Jacksonville on the coast, they vote Republican. But the GOP does very well, on the, generally speaking, anywhere that has a short line.
I assume, though, the largest Democratic base is black.
Yes, it is black. Also, but Florida doesn't have as big of a black population as other states do in the South. It has the smallest black population of any southern state, actually, from what I recall. And it's smallest per capita, I mean. Mm-hmm. And it has a white progressive voter base in Orange County and in South Florida. But mm-hmm. it also has a sort of Hispanic loyal Democratic base. But that is changing because Trump mm-hmm. and the GOP made quite a few inroads with it in its two citadels, which are the Orlando Metro and the Miami Metro.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and actually in Miami, I need to back that up a bit. Miami, the Hispanics who tend to be of Cuban background or Venezuelan background, they vote very, very strongly Republican. Mm-hmm. It's in Fort Lauderdale that the Hispanic population is more left-leaning. Mm-hmm. But even that's beginning to change. I didn't want to let that one slip. Anyway, if you have reasonable, responsible question or comment from Paul or myself, please do leave it via Streamlabs. Leave it as soon as you can, because the stream is not going on as long as some others have. Thank you very much in advance. Get your stuff in, folks. Just thought I would throw that out there again. All right, let me refresh Streamlabs, see if anything else came up. I'm waiting. This cartwheel is turning. It's turning. It's turning. The page is not loaded yet, but the cartwheel is turning. Sometimes Streamlabs loads very quickly. Sometimes it doesn't. I have no idea why it does this, but, you know, that is the way it is. No, nothing else came up for us, but get your stuff in quickly, folks, because, like I said, this won't go on as long as some other discussions have. So, Paul, I think it's very interesting what's going on with Trump in these rallies. He's getting a hell of a lot of people showing up for them.
Yes, he is.
I think he's clearly going to run in 2024. He's basically been dropping statements to that effect without actually announcing the candidacy. I don't know if he'll win in 2024. I think it's getting more and more difficult for any Republican to win because there are more and more of these cultural Democratic voters who will vote Democratic under any circumstances, even if the Democrat wants to, you know, take their house away or their apartment.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the Democratic administration is so disastrous right now that, you know, unless it can turn everything, I mean, it might get something in the long run out of having open borders and letting drug cartels and people carrying COVID come into the country illegally. But it'll take a while. They're not going to win with these people in the next election. And meanwhile, this really is giving the Biden administration a black eye. They also have to keep running Biden because Harris is a nincompoop. You know, I mean, any time you put her before a camera, she says something really stupid. She is not well-liked. Joe is still relatively well-liked. You know, his popularity is up. It's still in the high 40s, which, considering what a mess he's made and how stupid he sounds, is remarkable.
Yes.
I think the Democrats are going to have a real problem winning unless they cheat again. I think they cheated the last time, but they're going to have to cheat massively this time. And, you know, I don't know whether they're going to be able to pull it off. But I think the Republicans will be a shoo-in unless the Democrats can do something like HR 1 voting thing or come up with, you know, more truckloads of funny looking ballots like 4 o'clock in the morning in Miami or Detroit or somewhere. This is the only way. But they're still doing it. You know, in New York, they did this, absolutely, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, with Eric Adams. And it was like running away with the election. Suddenly it was like 200 votes ahead, you know, and falling back. As more and more of these strange ballots were turning up. So the Democrats had done this. My executive editor at Chronicles, Ed Welsh, pointed out to me that Norm Coleman, who lost the senatorial race in Minnesota, it was very similar.
Yes, it was.
Remember, he went against Al Franken. And he was like, mm-hmm. you know, ahead, he was winning and this. And suddenly these strange votes show up and they were all for Franken, you know, at the last. And I think he wins by like 500 votes or something.
Yes,
and they have to recount them, you know. But the Democrats are very good at doing this. They're very good at cheating. I think one of the reasons they were trying to, you know, pass HR 1 was they were afraid that all of these red states are going to start passing, as they're doing, about voter identification. By the way, I cannot figure out how you can have voter identification in Delaware and all these other states, Massachusetts, wherever, but insist that if you do this in Georgia, you're a racist. I have no idea. And you have like Coca-Cola going along with this, the Major League Baseball, I don't know, Delta Airlines or something. I have no idea, you know, how you can make this. It's ridiculous, the argument. We know why they're doing this. Rhode Island has these laws because it's states that the Democrats have already, majorities, unassailable majorities. They're quite happy to have voter identification. It's those states they're trying to steal from you when they don't want the voter identification.
Yep, absolutely. And George is an interesting case. I think that legitimately, even beyond the obvious fraud in 2020, I think that legitimately it is going to the Democrats because there's such a large base of lefties that have moved into the Atlanta area. It's been trending reliably leftward since 1988. Mm-hmm. And you have, in one respect, a huge black population that's come from urban centers of the Northeast and the upper Midwest. It's come down to Georgia, and it's made itself very, very well-known and abundant throughout the Atlanta metro, not just in DeKalb and Fulton counties. But then you have also now a lefty white population that's moved in from California due to Georgia's film tax credit program, which has attracted a lot of studios to the state. So I think that Georgia is going to be a Democratic state now. I think it already really is, but I think it's going to keep going Democratic regardless. I think it's the new Illinois, essentially, where you just have this one big city and all of its suburbs, or almost all of its suburbs, that control the state's politics. And even though the state votes overwhelmingly, the county on a county by county level votes overwhelmingly conservative, the state will still go to the left because of that urban center and its suburbs. Any thoughts on that, Paul?
Yeah, the other factor, I think, in Georgia, a critical factor, is the international base working in the Atlanta area, right, in high tech and electronics and so forth. These are people from India, from other places. Outside the United States, and typically from Asia. The same thing, by the way, has happened in Loudoun County in Virginia. You have a large Indian and Turkish population, and they work largely in high tech. They've moved in, and they have been able to radicalize that county. On the other hand, there is quite a pushback now coming from the white population. Because of critical race theory, because of the leftist drift or the leftist lunge of the teachers unions, and there's protest all over there. The question is, you know, will that sort of white indigenous vote be able to carry the next election? And right now, it looks like the Republican who's running there, who doesn't exactly excite me, is running neck and neck with Terry McAuliffe.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's the Glenn Youngkin is his name. Right. I think he'll lose. I think that Virginia will go to the Democrats. I think they have the Democratic majority, but it will be interesting to see how, if there is indeed a sort of softening of Democratic support in the Northern Virginia suburbs and in the Richmond suburbs for, over the critical race theory issue, which certainly has been a big deal in Virginia specifically.
Yeah, the other thing is, I don't think McAuliffe is particularly popular. Mm-hmm. He's corrupt, old. Mm-hmm. He's been around for a very, very long time. He doesn't really excite anybody. I've seen him in some of his, appearances, stump appearances. He looks ridiculous, like dancing around, trying to show people how youthful he is. He's sort of a bumbling, overweight, machine politician. I don't know whether he's running against a younger, much more vibrant candidate, although not exactly, as I said, somebody, you know, who excites me if he's running. But he may well lose this. I think the important thing is whether the black voting population comes out in Richmond, whether he can pull enough of the votes from these Washington suburbs, like in the counties the counties adjacent to Washington. And all these people are fighting back against critical race theory, crime, all these other things. So these areas may not vote as solidly Democratic as they have in the past.
And now, this is not the last call, but it is the call before the last call. If you have a reasonable, responsible question or comment for Paul or myself, please do leave it via Streamlabs. Thank you very much in advance. Once again, this is not the last call, but it is the call before the last call. So get your stuff in as soon as you can. Thank you very much. Now, you know, one thing I think will be interesting is seeing how the GOP does with this audit in Arizona of, you know, the 2020 election. Obviously, the Democrats who say it's a joke, they hate it, it's BS, they've been very adamant about trying to get it shut down. It's almost like they fear what the audit will find. So if it does show that there was some serious problems, were some serious problems with the election, my theory is that it will just be memory hold. They'll just try to ignore it, try to, you know, discredit it, and eventually try to make people forget that it ever happened. And obviously, if the audit comes out showing that everything was great in Arizona, then that'll be that. But Paul and the left will use that, you know, as fodder for months, weeks, whatever. Paul, anything, any thoughts on the situation?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, they'll try to shove it down a memory hole. But there are just too many of these things that are kind of... There is this like this 3-day conference that Mike Lindell, who's voted, I don't know, spent fortunes on this, doing these cyber studies of the election and so forth. He supposedly is presenting enough data to show that there was massive fraud involved. Democracy Institute is another outfit that I think is shown this very effectively, that there's just too many voting irregularities, too many funny things happen, or too many ballots showed up late at night and so forth. And I think what happens in Arizona may just be the straw that breaks the camel's back here. And you already have over 40% of the population thinking the election was stolen. So I don't know exactly how you deal with it. Obviously the Wall Street Journal type Republicans and some of the Fox News types and so forth, they want us to think that everything is really on the up and up and we should accept the results. And this, the question is, if these people, and I'm one of them who thinks the election was stolen, I do not hide my views here at all. I think there were just too many irregularities. I don't know whether Trump actually won. I certainly know that there were massive fraud that went on. I'm sure of that. I've studied this enough to know that's the case. Well, how do you go on from here? Because the same thing is happening in New York City right now, right? And the Democrats are going to go on doing this because they can get away with cheating, and the media are behind them. Their entire base, including the woke white people, are behind them. How do you indicate that you know they're cheating and you don't accept the results of the election? What makes it even harder by now is they control the military. And the Secret Service. So people are afraid to talk because they're going after Trump voters and so forth. But this is not going to end well, by the way. I think it's going to go on and on. I'm not sure the Democrats are going to win more and more votes. I think what you're going to see is more and more fraud taking place.
They certainly will try to. In Georgia, with the law they passed, it will make it more difficult for that to happen. But there were some loopholes in the Georgia legislation, as I've seen. And the Atlanta Democratic fraud machine is obviously very intelligent. They're not just going to. My theory is that the people actually running it are very intelligent, but the people who they get to do the grunt work probably are not that intelligent. So it's rather a two-tiered system there. But I think that there still will be fraud in Atlanta, but maybe not as much, probably not as widespread. But in any case, Florida passed a very good election integrity bill, as did Arizona. I hope that, you know, this stuff pans out well. And Pennsylvania is trying to do that. But they have, of course, the governor, Tom Wolf, who's not going to sign anything to that effect. But they might do an audit now, the Pennsylvania Senate, which is very Republican. And it's not like Jonah Goldberg or David French Republican either.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, the Republicans in the Pennsylvania Senate are very solid. And Wolf is very solid. He is a tool in the hands of the Democratic machine. very unappealing politician, but he's able to win because the teachers unions and the public sector unions pull out all stops for him every time. And of course you get very large black turnout for him. Mm-hmm. So it may be almost impossible to defeat this guy.
But he is term limited, so there's
I know that's the only way you're gonna get rid of him, but then he's gonna find some lookalike to run in his place.
Certainly. What do you think about John Fetterman running for the U.S. Senate? Do you think he'll be able to win?
I don't know. He's running as a Republican, isn't he?
No. Fetterman's the Democrat. He's the state lieutenant governor. He's the
socialist. Oh, that's right. Yeah. I hope he doesn't win. He's terrible. He's much worse than Wolf.
Yes, he is. He's sort of running as like a blue-collar commie version of Trump, which is rather interesting.
Yeah, but he's all the way over on the left. Yes. He gives me the sense of believing more in what he says than Wolf does. I mean, Wolf just sort of goes through the motions of doing things. He's just a tool, sort of like Amy Klobuchar in Minnesota. You know, he's just a machine tool. But Federman seems to be a nutcase. Now I remember him because I see him on local television every now and then. He's absolutely horrible. We were fortunate; we got rid of Rachel Levine.
I heard of it.
Yeah. She's now in Washington. She's not going to kill any more people here with COVID.
it's very interesting, the story of Rachel Levine. I won't get into it too much, but a very interesting story indeed. People can look it up and see how she has changed over the years. And now I will say this is the last call. If you have a reasonable, responsible question or comment for Paul or myself, please do leave it via Streamlabs. But leave it as soon as you can because we are going soon. This is the last call. Thank you very much in advance. I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with the midterms next year. I think the Republicans will do well. I'd be very surprised if they didn't do well. I think they will almost certainly win the U.S. House, and the Senate's more of a coin toss, but I think that they probably will win it very, very narrowly. It might be only 51-49, but I think they'll probably wind up picking that up. Any thoughts on any of this, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think they can win if the Democrats don't pull off more stunts with media approval and the approval of their entire voting base. That, you know, pretend nothing ever happened, but Republicans are trying to suppress black votes or something like that. Republicans have to be very, very careful the Democrats don't pull more tricks. Because they obviously this in November, they're doing this in New York, they've done this in other places. And the Republicans just don't, I mean, the Republicans have lawyers, they'll challenge things, but that's not the way we have to do is be sure in advance this doesn't happen. Which was not done in Pennsylvania or in Georgia in the November election or in some of these other states. So you're going to have to move in anticipation of what the Democrats are likely to do, which is to cheat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because when it comes to what the GOP is up to in Georgia, Vernon Jones is challenging Brian Kemp. Obviously for the gubernatorial nomination. And I think Kemp, I know that if he wins, he will lose to Stacey Abrams because a lot of the Georgia Republicans, as they did in January, will just sit out the election because they're so disgusted with Kemp. So I think Jones is the only real chance that the Georgia Republicans have to hold on to that seat. And Jones, I think, would be a phenomenal candidate for the GOP going forward. He's energetic. He's personable. He definitely reaches out to new constituencies for the party. And he's someone who I could see actually taking up the mantle of Trump. Paul, any thoughts on the situation in Georgia?
Yeah, I'm not even sure Kemp is going to lose. I think Stacey Abrams is so hated by anybody who's not on the left that she could even lose to Kemp. Vernon Jones is obviously a much better candidate. I don't think he's going to pick up large numbers of black votes. It's the same as Byron Donald in Naples, Florida. I mean, it's going to be wild. Or even in the case of Tim Scott in South Carolina, only won something like 32-33% of the black vote, which is a lot, you know.
Yes.
But you think he'd win a majority of them. You know, he's very black and grew up in a poor black. No, you know, they're going to vote for the Democrat no matter what, the vast majority of blacks. But I think Vernon Jones will energize whatever Republican base they have there. And some will run to vote for him because he is black, you know, and they can feel virtuous by doing it. He may pick up some of these suburban housewives. Stacey Abrams, I think, may by now have shot her wad. Apparently, she's involved in all kinds of real estate and other deals. She's having some problems with her finances. And the question is, what is she doing with all this money she's collected? And suddenly her lifestyle has improved very conspicuously. And they're going after her for, I think, basically for embezzling money and putting in real estate and other stuff, buying a very expensive house for herself. And the question, where did she get this money? And we know where she got the money, right? That's the problem. So I think she may face some of these problems or some of these questions running. And that may cut into her suburban white base, right? And I think Jones may pick up these things, and these soccer moms may be virtuous voting for a black man. Mm-hmm. I think she would certainly lose to Vernon Jones, but I'm not sure she'd win running against Kemp either.
I have to say that I'll say two things. Number one, Kemp is a uniquely bad GOP candidate, even beyond the Vernon Jones, Stacey Abrams business, because Trump hates him. And Trump said at one of his rallies, it might have been better if Stacey Abrams won. I think that Jones is, excuse not Jones, definitely not Jones. I think that
right.
Kemp is sort of the poster child for Republican weakness while pretending to be strong. And I think that particularly galls a lot of Republican voters.
Yeah, I think Kemp got back some of his support because of the voting restriction laws that, you know, he's pushed through in the face of this ridiculous criticism from woke corporate capitalism and the national Major League Baseball and so forth. But, he sort of stood his ground. It wasn't any great triumph of the right or something that was, but, you know, he did something to sort of redeem himself. But there's no question that Vernon Jones would be the stronger candidate. And I think Jones was probably going to win primary.
Yeah, I think he probably will win himself.
Yeah.
And the second thing was, one thing Stacey Abrams has going for her is her natural beauty. Certainly that will compel a great deal of men to vote for her in any case. She just has to, I think, do some swimsuit modeling and she will have the gubernatorial victory locked up.
Hey, yes. because of her outstanding world-renowned beauty.
She actually wrote romance novels, interestingly. So mm-hmm. I guess that was her way. Mm-hmm. Perhaps since she wasn't having much romance herself, she decided to write the novels. Anyway, now before I say something that gets me into trouble, I will check Streamlabs. I'm refreshing the page, having made the last call. Let's see if anything else is here for us before we depart this evening. Let's see, from Rick Heidinger. I hope I pronounced that correctly, Rick. Does Paul Urquhart have a take on James Burnham and or recent popular conservative critiques of the managerial class? I have not read Burnham thoroughly, although I obviously do know who he is. He certainly is a fan of administrative statism more than I am, although he doesn't like the leftist administrative statism, that goes without saying. But I do think that he had some very good critiques of the leftist managerial class. The problem is that he basically wanted to establish a right-wing version of it. You can even put that in air quotes, so right-wing, I mean. So it's interesting. But I think Paul, in terms of, you know, recent popular conservative critiques of the managerial class, even though his critiques aren't nearly as popular as they deserve to be, I think that Paul has done some brilliant critiquing of it, and everyone should read his work. I'm sure Paul will have a lot more to say about what Rick brought up than I do. So, Paul, anything to say about what Rick brought up?
You know, I'm a fan of James Burnham, right?
Certainly.
And I actually met him in his nonage. He had a stroke shortly before I met him and was not really capable of much conversation. I do respect him as a scholar. And I think the Manager Revolution is a classic. If one overlooks certain problems, like he expects Nazi Germany to win, you know, the competitive struggle, the struggle among the managerial blocks, that they're gonna come out on top because they're really well organized or something, you know. The rest of the work, you know, it sort of seems antiquated because a lot of what he's saying has happened, right? Which is the managerialization of culture, politics, economics, and so forth. I mean, it's all come to pass. And he believes, of course, it's irreversible. Now, this is very important in explaining the mindset, you know, of the populist right, which is really Burnham-esque. And of course, his most passionate exponent was Sam Francis, who saw himself as Burnham's successor. And, you know, our associate editor, Pedro Gonzalez, is a great admirer of Sam Francis, who also sees himself in the tradition of Burnham. You know, the view is that managerialism is here to stay. You're not going to undo it. And you're going to have to live with some kind of public administration. These are really interlocking units, the economy, the culture, and the state. You know, they all, and these managerialities, you know, travel back and forth from one to the other. This is just the way things are going to be. And of course, Burnham's view was that, you know, the bourgeois civilization that had preceded it would not be supplanted by a Marxist revolution, although Burnham began as a Trotskyist, right? And he was the highest ranking Trotskyist in the United States for a while. But he did not think it would result in a Marxist revolution. It would result in a managerial revolution. The managers would take over. The argument that he makes is one that's already inherent in or at least latent. It's not latent. It's actually present in Trotsky. Trotsky says that what happened in the Soviet Union was a managerial derailment of true socialism that starts with Lenin. Then the managers take over, so it ceases to be real socialism. Well, you know, this is sort of the starting point for Burnham, because the argument that he's making is that managerialism becomes the dominant form of organization, you know, and replaces bourgeois, the bourgeois economy and the bourgeois civilization that preceded it. But the right-wing Burnhamites are generally not, you know, defenders of free market economics. They think we're not going to go back there. It's just lost. And we have to do is find a reactionary or conservative or counter-revolutionary form of managerialism. Sometimes they do sound almost vaguely fascist, you know, when they make these sorts of arguments. But, you know, so does Burnham. I mean, and you basically have to deal with what the hand history gives you, and you're not going to undo this managerialization of society.
No, I don't think that the toothpaste we put back in the tube, but I think that attempts to establish a right-wing bureaucracy to counter the left-wing mm-hmm. one will necessarily end in failure, because basically lefties are attracted to bureaucracy. So the people who are going to be running whatever deep state you set up are going to be people who despise your politics, and they'll subvert then the bureaucracy which you intended to have provide for a stable society.
Yeah, there's another aspect to this. Where I break from most of these Burnhamites, including my late friend Sam Francis. And, you know, we had these furious arguments on this point. Sam believed that that the ideologies, you know, that are adopted by the managerial class don't really mean much. You know, just that within a particular society, certain ideas, you know, have currencies, you go with them. But the managers don't really take them seriously, except as an instrument of rule. So, you know, here I'm going to be a fascist, there I'm going to be a communist, or talk about women's rights. But none of this really matters to the people in charge, because they're just interested in power. Mm-hmm. Now, I do not believe that. Mm-hmm. I think they really believe this nonsense, this ideological lunacy that they're pushing. They're totally contaminated by it. And I think at the end of the day, it's because I'm much more of a religious thinker. And I believe that people take religious myths seriously. And, you know, they, and many of them look like, you know, distorted, perverted versions of Christians or Judeo-Christian myths or something like that. And, you know, and these are the ones that have currency because they fit most closely with the religious culture that preceded the rise of this managerial left. So I, you know, I think you can brush this off. And the ideology, to some extent, controls your actions and sort of shapes the kind of regime that you have. So if you look not very deeply among the Burnhamites, and this is certainly true of Sam, there is almost a kind of Marxist grid that, you know, everything is materialistic or power driven. And there's really, you know, there's sort of, it's almost a sort of materialistic. Almost, it's not quite Marxist. It's more like sort of Machiavellian, but it's everything is driven by power, or Hobbesian, maybe Hobbes would be closer. It's driven by power, and that's all they're interested in. You know, I would say that, you know, would that things were that simple. And I think ideology is extremely important. What I call political religions. They're dominant in our age. You know, there's no way you can escape their influence. And the only elites that can rule are the ones who rule in the name of these ideologies, which they themselves accept and which they then promulgate almost like a church state.
Yeah, it's really an interesting story trying to figure out what makes people tick. Paul is more of a religious thinker. I'm more materialistic, but I do give more credence to the religious angle than a lot of other materialist thinkers and analysts mm-hmm. do. So it's really fascinating. I would think that it's scary as it is to believe a lot of these hardcore lefties who, you know, believe that, you know, a five-year-old should transition. I think they actually do believe that it's a moral good. I don't think it's mm-hmm. just because they're trying to trigger people on the right.
No, I think you're right. I think they think they're doing something that's morally good. I think the left is driven by moral passion. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've argued this again and again. I mean, they're vicious, they're killers, they're brutal, they're intolerant. What they're saying is lunatic, but I think there's moral passion there. And you can't deny that it's present. Whereas you listen to, you know, Mitch McConnell, I would never confuse him or take him, you know, for a morally driven individual.
Most certainly not, no. And I prefer people who are not morally driven because they're much easier to reason with. But when people do get on these moral crusades, and that's what they are, crusades, there's really no reasoning with them because they believe they're right, you're wrong, and that's that.
Yeah, I think the moral passion is also mingled with hate against certain groups, you know, they think are evil people. They want to destroy them. It's mingled with hate and nihilism. I mean, they're very destructive, the left. They want to destroy everything. I remember once having this debate with someone saying, well, the Nazis, you know, they were relativist, or they didn't would that they were relativist. I mean, they really believe this stuff. So when they went around killing you. I've always found this argument that people on the people on the other side, you get this from conservatives, by the way, they're relativist. I have never met a relativist in my life. Have you? I mean, everybody believes his values are the best values. And you're going to stuff them down other people's throats. So I'm waiting to meet these relativists. What I meet are people who are morally crazed, you know, just the opposite.
And, you know, it's interesting. I suppose one could say there's moral relativism. I would make this argument, but it's a very qualified one, that all forms of morality are relative in that people perceive something as being productive or destructive, good or bad, on the basis of what subjectively seems to them to be, you know, worthy of being considered productive, destructive, good or bad. But at the same time, people do believe that what they stand for is the best thing, unless they're just totally pragmatic and they don't really, you know, care about much of anything. And it's only a very small segment of the population.
Yeah, no, you're right. There are people like that, you know, they're just, but their highest values become, you know, just making out well.
Yes.
But very often they end up serving the moral fanatics.
Absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Yes. I think they always do, because the moral fanatics are going to command leadership roles because they're much more captivating than people who just, you know, are totally pragmatic. Most people aren't going to rally. Virtually no one is going to rally behind pure pragmatism. And this is from David B. I presume this is going to be the last one of the night, but I will double check to make sure I haven't missed anything. I have learned more from this conversation than from most college courses I took. Thanks. Well, David, that's a very profound compliment. You're most welcome, and thank you for the kind words. Paul, anything to say about what David?
Yeah, I mean, having been a college professor for 40 years, I don't know whether I should be complimented.
Well, considering how bad most colleges
that's
are,
right.
I think it's very clearly a compliment, and I'm very grateful for it.
No, yes, no, I'm grateful, and it was intended as a compliment, and I accept it that way.
Most certainly so. And I do believe that is it, but I will double check. I'm going to do the refresh right now to make sure we haven't missed anything. What I will say is that this has been another great discussion, Paul. I've enjoyed it very much, and I it seems clear that you've enjoyed it as well, but I'll just make sure. Have you enjoyed it?
Oh, yes. I learned a great deal about Florida politics from listening to you. I didn't know about these counties and how they run and so forth.
Excellent. And maybe I can write for Chronicles about Florida politics at some point. Mm-hmm. I think that's definitely worth opining on.
Yes. Oh, it is. Yeah.
Yeah, and although it's very misunderstood in many cases. But anyway, folks, no, that is it. The last thing tonight was from David. So I will just say that before we leave, I do have this here book that I wrote, Runaway Masters. I like the title. Paul likes the title. Please consider checking it out on Amazon. And I will probably do a show just with me about it and other things, give a Q&A nature. So anyway, Runaway Masters, you get it now on Amazon in paperback version, which you see here, as well as on Kindle. And if you have Kindle Unlimited, it's free. So, Paul, thank you very much for another great chat tonight.
Well, thank you for inviting me on again.
Well, as much as I can invite on my co-host, that is.
Okay.
Anyway, take good care, everyone. Have a great night. I actually forgot what I was going to say. Oh, yeah, see you next time. Before we go, though, if you like this episode and want to support the show, please consider donating to it by clicking on the PayPal link in the description below. Paul and I appreciate your generosity very much. Cheers, all.